Joe Bradley, who's an emeritus professor of physics at Wheaton College. He's going to discuss, as you can see from his title already, methodological naturalism in sort of the ancient and medieval periods, going back very early in history. Then that will be followed by me, Robert Bishop. I'm the McIntyre Chair for Philosophy and History of Science at Wheaton College, and I'll be talking about methodological naturalism in the scientific revolution. That will be followed by Ron Numbers, who's the Hilldale Professor of History and of History of Science and Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he's going to discuss basically the big changes that take place as we move through the second half of the 18th century through the 19th century. Now, at that point, Bruce Gordon, who is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and associate professor for science and mathematics at the King's College, will give us a presentation describing, from his perspective, how should we or what should we as Christians think about and do about methodological naturalism in our own context. Once we've moved through our historical context, what about today's situation? We'll then take a break. What we'll do is basically take, roughly the 30-minute break that's in the schedule so that we keep on track with all the rest of the concurrent sessions. And then once we come back for the break, Catherine Applegate, who is the program director at the BioLogos Institute, will then speak from her perspective about what should we as Christians think in our current context about methodological naturalism. And then if everything goes to plan, we'll shift to a panel discussion where we should have about 40 minutes, that will provide us a lot of time to interact with you as an audience, perhaps interact with each other, have some fireworks if those arise, whatever. We'll just see how that goes. So let's begin with Joe Spradley. Yes.
You know if this works. Okay. Well, those of you that were here last night probably saw me wobble up to the stage and receive a 50-year recognition. I taught at Wheaton College for 52 years, although the last 2 years have been as an adjunct professor. So let me begin this topic, see if this works. Nope. Well, I want to begin by talking about examples of methodological naturalism in ancient Greek science. I understand from Ron Numbers that the term methodological naturalism actually began at Wheaton College, one of my former colleagues, Paul DeVries. So we've had some familiarity with this terminology for quite a while. A very simple working definition, methodological naturalism, scientific explanations refer to natural causes and events. That doesn't mean that you have to be a naturalist, but that scientific explanations would be so limited. For Christians, I think there is, and religious people in general, considerable amount of motivation that comes from their religious commitments, but in doing science, this is the restriction within which we work. And I want to give then some examples of this. Throughout the ancient early civilizations, Babylonian and Egyptian, almost all explanations were religious explanations. And as a result, not very much progress was made. But about the 6th century B.C., what sometimes is called the Greek miracle, occurred. The first natural philosophers, pre-Socratics in the Ionian region along the coast of Asia Minor, and they began for the first time to attempt to give natural explanations rather than religious. Just a couple of examples. Thales, all things are water. Had recognized that water takes on different forms, solid, liquid, gaseous form. So perhaps everything is water, an attempt to explain all. A monistic explanation, perhaps too speculative for modern thinking, but an attempt to give that kind of explanation. You begin to get others then picking up this same idea. By about the 5th century, Heraclitus suggests all things are fire. He wants to emphasize that everything is changing, and fire causes change in everything. And this fire, however, is not just random occurrences or chaotic completely. He introduces the logos concept, the idea of an ordered sequence of events, the basis of the word logic. And of course, eventually, in John's Gospel, this is picked up as a way of describing the Son of God. But even in this period, these people still are dependent very much in their thinking about the activity of the gods. Heraclitus, among some of the few fragments that we have, would welcome guests into his home and point to the fire and say, "Here also are gods." In other words, the gods still are active, but they tried to restrict their explanations to these natural events. Now, let me take one other example. This is in the late pre-Socratic period. Anaxagoras at Athens had come from the Ionian region. He had something of this materialistic bias of the Ionians, but came into contact also with Pythagorean ideas of mathematical order. And around 450 BC in Athens, a friend of Pericles, by the way, in fact, perhaps even a mentor of Pericles, but he suggests that mind orders matter, beginning to combine these mathematical and materialistic emphases of the Ionians and the Pythagoreans. And I think one of the best examples of the power of this new approach can be seen in Anaxagoras' explanation of the phases and eclipses of the moon. The first successful explanation of these rather what we consider simple phenomena, but yet for at least 2,000 years of high civilization, no one had attempted to give a natural explanation for the phases of the moon and the eclipses of the moon. These were the behaviors of the gods. If the gods willed to behave in one way or another, to change their shape, who are we to question that? But Anaxagoras, suggesting first of all, and this is a radical step, although even in our devotions this morning we saw that the stars were recognized in the biblical tradition as the part of the created order, but in most of the ancient world they were viewed as gods, sun and the moon and so on. But Anaxagoras for the first time suggests that matter, celestial matter even, is not divine. He had studied meteorites, for one thing, and he suggested, for example, that the Earth is a ball of, the moon is a ball of Earth. Earth, the four elements by this time had emerged, Earth, water, air, and fire. So he suggests that the moon is a ball of Earth. And he even suggested that there are mountains on the moon, that these were not perfectly configured objects as most Greeks came to believe. And he suggested that the sun also is not divine, but simply a mass of fire. With those ideas, then, he could begin to think about what causes the phases and eclipses of the moon. The fact that the moon reflects the light of the sun, and then using the mathematical geometry of the Pythagorean tradition, could begin to show why we have the phases that we do. And eventually, because of this explanation, and I'll give the diagram just in a moment here, but He was attacked by Cleon for impiety and was exiled out of Athens, even though he was protected by Pericles, but Pericles helped him to leave and for his own safety. So I guess methodological naturalism has not always been a very safe position to take. Well, just very briefly, this is probably carrying coals to Newcastle, but just to emphasize, not sure what is wrong with the aspect ratio. It's just where I'm standing, or can I change that? Well, anyway, the idea then being that if the moon is a material object and the sun also is, then the reflection of the light of the moon, the side toward the sun, will always be illuminated. And as viewed from the earth, then you'll see the various phases. And as the moon passes through the shadow of the earth, which doesn't occur every month because of the inclination of the moon's axis, of the moon's orbit, but you would have then a lunar eclipse, or if it passes between the sun and the moon, sun and the earth, a solar eclipse. Well, that it always surprises me, and I think my students are also surprised to see how late this explanation emerges in the history of science. And it required this kind of methodological naturalism before it became possible to think this way. Now, a couple further examples. Aristotle does carry on something of this tradition in his synthesis of Greek science, especially in his biology. His biological classifications are largely an approach that we would describe as a methodological and naturalistic approach. But when it comes to his overall cosmology, geocentric cosmology, he makes a dichotomy between the heavens and the earth. The divinity of the heavens is a part of his cosmology over against methodological naturalism. Let me flip back and forth here just a moment to talk about this. These should be perfect circles, but at least they're elliptical. At any rate, you have the four elements, earth, air, water, and fire. This is the region of change, the terrestrial region. And then, and reflecting the tradition of Heraclitus, and then beyond the moon, superlunar, you have the celestial region, the region of perfection, where there the only changes, all the motions are circular. That's a constant distance always from the center. And this is the region then that he associates with divinity, and especially the prime mover himself that energizes the whole system. But you have this great chain of being then, the hierarchy that combines both the religious and the scientific views of the time. While I'm talking about Aristotle, I should say just a word about his views of motion, because that comes up when we talk later on about Philoponus and John Buridan. For Aristotle, motion requires a mover. That was the largest hurdle in the scientific revolution, because the principle of inertia didn't seem even something that one normally observed, that objects continued to move without any mover. Whenever you see something moving, they always thought they could identify a mover. But there was a problem associated with the motion of a projectile. Once it leaves the hand of the person that throws it, it no longer has a mover. And so what keeps that mover motion going? And so Aristotle makes the distinction between violent motion and then natural motion, where gravity eventually takes over. Didn't quite know what the transition was, but the violent motion, he introduced a rather complicated principle, anti-peristasis, circulation of the air, to supply the mover. Namely, well, one other principle, he did not believe the possibility of a void. So as the object moves, the air must rush out from the front to fill up the back so there won't be a void. And that circulation then keeps the object moving until the circulation eventually dies down and natural motion takes over. Then, again, this is pretty much an attempt at a natural explanation, but somewhat speculative, especially in terms of this concept of antiperistasis. So motion requires a mover. That's one of the big hurdles, as I suggested, in the development of the scientific revolution, and also this idea that there isn't no possibility of a void. One last example from the Greek period, Aristarchus in the Alexandrian period. I think he was one of the directors of the Alexandrian Museum, or perhaps he had returned to Rhodes, I think it was. But anyway, the first to introduce the possibility that the sun is at the center of the universe. He wrote a book about 250 BC on the sizes and distances of the sun. We have references to that, at least by Archimedes, although the book itself... Well, some of it may be available, but at any rate, in that book, he gives a demonstration that the sun is much larger than the earth. And as a result, he suggests that it's much more reasonable that the earth should go around the sun. Demoting the sun, some would say that would be promoting the sun, putting it at the center, but the fact that they didn't like the idea of manipulating the gods, so he was attacked by Cleanthes for his impiety. I don't think that led to exile, but according to Plutarch, there was that charge of impiety. Let me take just a minute to comment on that demonstration of Aristarchus. Using pretty much some of the same ideas that Anaxagoras had. When you have a half moon illuminated on the side toward the sun, then you know immediately that this angle must be a right angle. And you can then measure the angle between the moon and the sun. His conservative estimate was about 87 degrees. It was closer to almost 90 degrees, but slightly smaller, but 87 perhaps the best he could estimate, which means that this would only be 3 degrees, giving 180 for the total angles of the triangle. And that means that this would be a very, very elongated triangle. If you use a projector and set up a 3-degree triangle, you'll find that the Earth-Sun distance is about 20 times the Earth-Moon distance. And since they both appear to have the same apparent size, half a degree in the sky, that suggests that the sun must be 20 times larger than the moon. Then Aristarchus further measured the time of an eclipse of the moon, and he noticed, I don't think the moon was right at the center of the shadow, so he didn't have a very accurate result here, but he concluded that the moon is about half the size of the Earth. It took maybe 1 hour to get it completely eclipsed, and then about another hour before it began to start to leave the eclipse. So he estimated the moon about half the size of the Earth, and that led him then to conclude that the sun is at least 10 times the size of the Earth. Modern values are quite a bit larger, the sun some 100 times larger than the Earth. But even if it's only 10 times smaller than the sun, it's much more reasonable to see the Earth going around the sun than the very large sun going around the Earth. And that was what he concluded, but with very little support. I need to press on or I'll not finish here, but let me talk now about the transition to the Christian period. The early church background and largely developing this logos principle of Heraclitus into a theology which I think is a sound basis for methodological naturalism. During the first century after Christ, first couple of centuries, Greek science had more and more tended toward a Neoplatonic mysticism. And as a counter to that, you get the Christian emphasis then on the order of the universe based on the Logos. One of the earliest, Justin Martyr, 2nd century, was eager to not turn his back on the Greek tradition, but at the same time not to be dragged into this mystical approach of the Neoplatonists. Just one quote here: whatever has been uttered aright by any man in any place belongs to us Christians. For next to God, we worship and love the reason, Logos, which is from God. So these early apologists began to recognize the importance of the order of creation, the created order. Tertullian, even though he challenged this connection between Athens and Jerusalem, in his famous quote, "What is there in common between Athens and Jerusalem? What between the academy and the church? Away with all projects for a Stoic or dialectic Christianity." But at the same time, he recognized the importance of the Logos idea. God made this universe by his word and reason and power. Your philosophers also are agreed with the artificer of the universe, seems to be the Logos. So even Tertullian accepts this idea. First to really exploit that idea, though, for science, and perhaps we can identify him as the first Christian scientist, is John Philoponus. One of the last of the members of the Alexandrian Museum. He, at least from some sources, he converted to Christianity, perhaps a little later in... hard to know exactly when because we don't have a lot of information. But he then began to devote his life at the Alexandrian Museum to a critique of Aristotle. And he was the first then to combine cosmology with monotheism, according to Sambursky, who I'll give a couple of other quotes in a moment. He was a Christian in a tradition that we call monophysite. He believed that Christ had only one nature, not two, that he was basically, his deity was his basic nature, and his humanity was only an appearance. Eventually, he was charged with being a heretic for that view, but it had the advantage at this point, the emphasis on the deity of Christ, to again put a strong emphasis on the Logos principle, and especially then the unity of nature over against the divinity of the heavens. Just one quote here from Philoponus: "One star differs from another star in glory," says Paulus. "Indeed, there is much difference among them in magnitude, color, and brightness." Notice the observational basis for his approach. "And I think that the reason for this is to be found in nothing else than the composition of the matter of which the stars are constituted. They cannot be simple bodies, for how could they differ but for their different constitution?" Well, in his critique of Aristotle, he began to introduce new ideas about motion. For one thing, he viewed over against the Greeks the fact that creation means that the world is finite in age, not eternal. And therefore, as a created, with a created source, the stars were material objects moving through the void. So he's beginning to reject some of these ideas of Aristotle. He then recognizes from simple experiments that falling objects are independent of their weight. Aristotle said that heavy objects fall faster than light objects. And he began to try to correct Aristotle's ideas of projectile motion, suggesting that rather than antiperistasis, that when you throw an object, you impart a quality to it that he, well, this is a bit anachronistic. He didn't call it impetus himself. He refers to it as a kind of motive power that keeps the object moving. It's just a quality like heat. When you heat an object, it remains hot for a while. When you throw an object, it's the motive force remains and it continues to move. Much simpler explanation than the anti-peristasis. And he also suggests that in the celestial motions, that the motions of the planets does not involve gods or angels, but rather a kind of celestial impetus. God set the planets in motion, and they continue to move. Well, let me just read quickly here a couple of examples of Philoponus. It's taken from Samburski, but these are quotes from Philoponus. If one lets fall simultaneously from the same height two bodies differing in weight, one will find the ratio of their times of motion does not correspond to the ratio of their weights, but that the difference in time is a very small one. And then some incorporeal kinetic power is imparted by the thrower to an object. If an arrow or a stone is projected by force in a void, the same thing will happen much more easily, nothing being necessary except the thrower. So he's using this idea that eventually came to be called impetus, and then Galileo eventually calls it inertia. Now, he also is responsible, Philoponus, for the invention of the astrolabe. And his ideas were picked up in Islamic science. His works were translated into Arabic, and they developed the astrolabe further. But the astrolabe was often used for setting the earth, the Christian calendar, date of Easter, and so on. This is an example of the use of the astrolabe, but it's one of his practical contributions as well as his critique. Well, you may think that it's a long stretch to go from Philoponus to Galileo, but let me see if I can fill that in a little bit. In the Islamic period, not only did they develop the astrolabe, but also the impetus theory, but they viewed it as a self-dissipating force, and they did not apply it to celestial motion. They still viewed the heavens as, along with Aristotle, as divine. In the medieval period, Philoponus was translated from Arabic into Latin around the 12th century, and then Buridan at the University of Paris picks up on the idea, hears a lecture about it, and begins to develop it, and uses the term impetus then, instead of motive power or kinetic power. And picks up the same idea of Philoponus. It is unnecessary to posit intelligences as the movers of celestial bodies. When God created the celestial sphere, he began to move each of them as he wished, and they are still moved by the impetus which he gave to them, because the impetus is neither corrupted or diminished. Now, some question about whether this book was also censored. According to Wikipedia, it was, but there's some question about that. But there's, at least for a period of time, there was appeared to be some suppression of Buridan. But when Galileo began studying, we have his notebooks, and the 1535 translation of Philoponus was available by that time to Galileo. I guess at Buridan's time, I'm not sure if it had been translated completely, but he did hear lectures on the ideas of Philoponus. In the early notebooks of Galileo, there is frequent mention of Philoponus. In his book on motion, he argues for a void and impetus. Later, he calls it inertia. And Kuhn, in his book on scientific revolutions, suggests that this is the paradigm shift that led to the scientific revolution, the idea of inertia eventually overcoming Aristotle's idea of anti-peristasis and so on. Just a couple of quotes from Galileo. I need to try to conclude here. There are 15 references to Philoponus in Galileo's early notebooks. Only five other authors have more reference than Philoponus. In On the Universe, from this question of whether the universe could exist from eternity, Galileo writes, "The third opinion is that of Philoponus, in the book which he replies to the arguments of Proclus for the eternity of the world." And On the Heavens, are the first opinion is that of Philoponus, holding that the heavens are corruptible of their very nature, and that sometimes they will finally come to corrupt. This is gathered from the solution of the sixth argument against Proclus, and so on. Well, now just to conclude, and I won't have time to develop this very much, but the deity of Christ was emphasized early on in the church by the church fathers and the Logos principle. But by the time you get to the monastic period, you begin to get an increasing emphasis on the humanity of Christ and the immanence of Christ, and an emphasis on manual labor, which is the missing element often in Greek science. In Benedict's manual on labor, idleness is the enemy of the soul. Therefore, he spells out the need for working with their hands. And St. Francis, on the goodness of nature, the example of Christ as a carpenter. All of these, I won't take time to go into detail, but they began to support a new awareness of the fact that the earth is created as God's good creation. In the Greek hierarchy, especially in Neoplatonism, you begin to get a hierarchy of the earth being evil compared to the heavens. That begins to break down. And one of the key figures in that breakdown is Hildegard of Bingen. I don't have time to develop her contributions very much. You think of her mostly as a mystic, but her emphasis on the humanity of Christ is quite clear. She's among the first to benefit from Latin translations of Arabic sources, began to revive the Greek ideas of the universe. George Sarton says she's the most distinguished naturalist and the most original medical writer of Latindom, 12th century. I would identify her as the first female Christian scientist. She uses the four elements then. She starts out with a kind of an egg-shaped universe, but eventually, when she begins to read Aristotle, she introduces a spherical universe. But her most important work, and where her methodological naturalism becomes clear, is in her classification of plants. Some 230 plants, 60 trees with medical applications, and in fact, German classifications still use her approach. This is in her last book then on cosmic medicine, tends to get a little more mystical, but there is this emphasis then on the goodness of the earth. It's a couple of scenes. This is receiving visions, and the kind of drawing she did. Some have suggested that this is evidence of her migraine headaches, which she talks about, but she had something in common, I guess, with Michelle Bachmann. So. Well, she talks about the four elements in a very earthy way. The things that live in the upper celestial region are made of fire and air. Those that move in the lower are palpable, consist of water and mud. For spirits are fiery and airy. Man is watery and muddy. When God created man, the mud he used was stuck together, and so on. Well, I think my time is just about over, so let me not take time to finish reading here. A diagram here of her cosmology as it began to develop from her reading of Aristotle and reintroducing the idea of a spherical earth in Europe. So by way of conclusion then, new attitudes and values of Christological thinking on the deity and humanity of Christ began to offer a new basis for the scientific revolution and an approach of methodological naturalism. Philoponus challenges the perfection and divinity of the heavens in favor of the unity of all the created order, revived by Burdon, influencing Galileo. And then Hildegard sparks a reawakening interest in science. Her book on medicine, that last one that I had mentioned, was used right up until the 15th century, I think, in France, making a positive value on the material world, placing a positive value, and initiating a new effort to describe medical plants.